asked Reese. 3 hours and 32 minutes until Umbrella lands, 4 hours until he goes on stage.
Every protectee or principal had a Secret Service code name. Umbrella was a reference to the 187th Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division, nicknamed by the Japanese as Rakasans, which meant Falling Down Umbrella Men. The president had commanded the Rakasans during Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, before being selected as vice president by the previous administration. "We have less than 4 hours, so do what you can. I know you'll come up with something. Out here." Freddie ended the call and turned to their Secret Service liaison. "Can you take us to the site?"
"Let's go. I'll drive. And let me get you to some lapel pins."
Chapter 79. Odessa, Ukraine. October. Reese and Freddie retrieved their gear bags and weapons from the back of the agency SUV and thanked Douglas for the ride. Agent Shear led them to a white Hyundai minivan that was obviously from a local rental agency's fleet.
"No Suburban?" Reese teased.
"Please. The advance team gets the shaft. All the cool guys on the PPD, that's the president's detail, get their vehicles flown in on C-17s for game day, and we get whatever Avis can't rent out that week."
Kim pulled out of the hotel and navigated the local streets like a native. She'd obviously spent some time in the area as part of the advance team.
"What's your background, Kim? Did you come straight to the Secret Service?" Freddie asked.
"No, I went to Annapolis. Then the Marine Corps. Got out as a captain, tried to go to work in the family's insurance business, but that made me want to blow my brains out. Applied for this job 5 years ago and have been here ever since. I love it."
"What did you do in the Corps?" Reese asked.
"Intel mainly. Supported some high-speed units, but didn't leave the FOB much."
"MARSOC?"
"They call them Raiders now, but yeah, I was attached as an intel officer."
"That's right. The artists formerly known as MARSOC. Hard to keep up with all of the name changes."
"I was attached to Det 1 in 2004 for a couple of months," Reese responded. "That was a solid group. I really learned a lot from them. Especially Major K. He used to run their Mountain Warfare Training Center. Great guy."
"He was squared away," Kim remembered.
"Was Gunny Gutierrez still around when you were there?" Reese asked.
"He sure was. Small world."
"It is indeed."
After showing her credentials to local police and making her way through the roadblocks, Agent Shear parked the minivan on Primorsky Boulevard and led the men toward the site of the speech. They walked along the gray cobblestone driveway past an impressive 19th-century columned building that had, at some point, been the residence of someone important. The gated perimeter had already been set up and the temporary fences funneled pedestrians into a tent with several airport-style magnetometers and package scanners. The uniformed personnel recognized the Secret Service agent and waved her through. As they cleared the checkpoint and rounded the building, the colonnade they'd viewed on the iPad imagery was directly in front of them. The area was smaller than Reese had expected it to be. The site had obviously been chosen for television viewing rather than its ability to accommodate a large physical audience. A stage had been built in front with two lecterns a few yards apart from each other. Last-minute preparations were being made by a variety of workers, while security personnel from the United States, Russia, and Ukraine moved busily about. They walked up onto the stage and looked around. The site of the speech sat on a high bluff, with the ground falling off sharply toward the sea below. From the land side of the colonnade, the site left very few options for a sniper. Tall trees and buildings surrounded the structure, leaving no discernible line-of-sight shooting lanes that wouldn't be locked down by the Secret Service. A long and modern pedestrian bridge connected the area from stage right to a more built-up area of the city, but only the rooftops and high windows of those buildings offered a shot toward the stage, and all would be occupied by authorities. Each member of the team spent several minutes taking in the scene, looking for something that had been overlooked by the other dozen sets of eyes
that had studied it as part of the overall security assessment. Reese broke the silence first.
"I'll be honest, Kim, this is a good spot."
"I agree," Freddy added. "The only thing that bothers me is the port, but you're saying it's been locked down?"
"Yep. Everything within 2,000 meters has been searched and secured. We have drones up looking for IR signatures and dog teams that have been working it all night and morning. The port is secure."
"What are we missing?" Reese asked himself as much as the others.
Far out on the horizon, past the closest set of docks and through a forest of dock cranes, sat a massive green and red tanker-style vessel with a handful of colorful shipping containers stacked on the deck. Strain pulled a laser rangefinder unit from his pack and aimed it toward the ship, bracing it against one of the columns for stability.
2,100 meters. Technically, you could make a shot from that far pier, but it would be a long one.
Sure would, especially in this wind. You think that's a legitimate threat, Freddy? What's the world record shot these days, anyway?
These records are changing every year or two, but the longest confirmed real-world shot was taken in Iraq by a Canadian sniper in 2017. Went 3,871 yards. He used a Macmillan TAC-50 like the ones we used to use. The shot took 10 seconds to reach the target.
"That's crazy," Reese said, shaking his head.
"It's damn fine shooting, buddy."
"No, I meant that you can remember all that stuff," Reese smiled. "How about on a controlled range?"
"To the best of my knowledge, a shooter out of Texas hit a 3-mile shot with a 408 Shytac in 2018. Before that, one of our old sniper instructors had it at 2.8 miles with the same round. Keep in mind, those are not under combat conditions and were done with the best rifle scope combinations available, shot by the most highly trained and capable snipers on Earth."
"So from those cranes and that ship," Reese said, gesturing to the distance, "it's a low-percentage shot, but not out of the realm of possibility. With the guns and optics that are out there now, it could be done. Could you have some people take a look at that far pier, Kim?"
"It's outside of the perimeter, but sure, I'll have someone check it out."
Agent Shear walked off a few steps and made a phone call. Gesturing with her hand as she spoke, she tried to describe the exact location of the tanker before hanging up and rejoining the group.
"That's the oil terminal, so it's not open to the public. It's gated, and local police are manning it. They're sending some of our people over there to look around, and we'll do a sweep with the UAVs as well."
"Okay, good. Let's keep looking. I still feel like something is off."
"The Secret Service does extensive research into the threats to POTUS," Kim explained, "at every location, on every itinerary. Ever since President Kennedy, we have been extremely sensitive to sniper threats against the president, for obvious reasons. No one wants to relive the nightmare that was Dallas. So, ever since 1963, we've kept data of every military and law enforcement sniper, and with the advent of social media, we've kept tabs, using open-source information, on civilians going to shooting schools run by former military snipers. Anytime POTUS makes a stop, we've cross-referenced everything in a given area, including incoming travelers, whose names we get from TSA, to those former MIL-LE and civilian-trained long-range shooters. They each get checked out, and any in the vicinity of a POTUS stop are flagged. Facial recognition technology helps a lot."
"That's thorough," Reese remarked. "But here you don't have that information on foreign-trained snipers."
"The database is fairly robust, thanks to the folks at the NSA, but you're right. Nothing's 100%. We have good intel on U.S., Canadian, and European-trained snipers, who are the ones that coincidentally have the best shot at taking out the president. According to our assessment, other countries just don't have the training or equipment required to make a shot past 2,000 yards. That's stretching it, even for us."
Reese nodded and looked out to sea. "The Shoshone is here, Kim. I know it. He's in place. He's waiting. That sniper is here."
Oliver Gray recognized James Reese from the media coverage following his attacks on various civilian and military individuals across the United States the previous year.
He looks a lot like his father did.
Reese and his two colleagues had taken no interest in him as they walked past in front of the Bootlegger, a gangster-themed pub that sat on the ground floor of a taller building near the colonnade. Gray was sitting at a table on the sidewalk reading the local Russian-language newspaper and drinking coffee like just another local going about his day. Since the pub sat well below the high ground where the presidents would speak, the street where it was located would remain open until just before the event began. The fact that Reese was walking with another Westerner and what looked to be a female Secret Service agent meant that he had worked his way back into the good graces of the U.S. government. This explained why Jules Landry had fallen off the radar, which meant that this operation had been compromised. Still, it was too late to call it off now. They would never get another opportunity like it. Gray had long since passed the point of no return, and the operation had reached a similar point. There was no going back. Chapter 80.
Tell me about your counter-sniper setup, Reese said.
The three Americans were standing on the roof of a large apartment building in the midst of renovation that overlooked the colonnade. A Secret Service sharpshooter, dressed from head to toe in black BDUs, was setting up what looked like an AR-10 on the roof parapet. A giant pair of well-worn 1980s vintage Steiner binoculars sat nearby. Next to the American was another black-clad sniper, wearing a matching beret with a colorful badge. His rifle, a black chassis-style bolt-action with a Night Force scope, was cradled in a tripod mount alongside a separate tripod that held both a Leica spotting scope and a pair of range-finding binoculars. It wasn't lost on Reese or Strain that the Russians seemed to have superior equipment to the Americans, at least when it came to optics.
Well, it depends on where we are, but in this case we have our guys paired up with Russian counterparts from the FSO, one U.S. shooter and one Russian, Kim explained. In some countries our folks aren't permitted to carry weapons, but they always at least shadow the local shooters so they can coordinate with the PPD.
Don't your people usually work in pairs? Asked Freddy.
Generally, yes, but not on this trip. This arrangement was a negotiated deal between the Russians and the Ukrainians. Besides, budget cuts hit us hard. We're low on agents as it is. This allows us to spread our people over a wider radius.
Sounds like a recipe for disaster, Freddy commented.
Let's hope not.
What rifle is that, Freddy? Asked Reese.
I think it's called a Tochnost. It's Russia's new sniper rifle. Supposedly a great gun, but I don't have any experience with it.
What about assaulters? What assets do we have on the ground? Reese asked, beginning to pace.
Cat, that's our counter-assault team, will be near the stage. Their job is to cover the PPD while they get Umbrella to safety. The Russians have their own team with a similar role. Neither is going to divert away from their principal. If there's a threat somewhere that we need to move on, the Ukrainian alphas will be the ones to do it.
Forgive me for bringing up the elephant in the room, Kim, but don't the Russians and Ukrainians hate each other? Russia is occupying Crimea, for Christ's sake, Freddy pointed out.
Our threat assessment teams analyze all that. Us agents, we leave the politics to the politicians.
That reminds me to check in with Andy.
Freddy stepped away from the counter-snipers and made a call. Reese and Kim followed and leaned in to hear the conversation.
This is Andy.
It's Strain. Anything new?
I was actually about to call you. I just heard from a contact at State. During his speech today, President Zubarov is going to announce that they're giving back Crimea. In exchange, the United States will drop its sanctions against Moscow, and the EU will buy a bunch of Russian natural gas. Our president praises Russia, and everyone shakes hands and sings Kumbaya.
That doesn't sound like it's in line with Andrenov's vision, Reese chimed in.
Not at all.
This is the kind of move that would make him want to take out a president, and if I know Andrenov, he'll find a way to spin it to his advantage.
How so?
If President Zubarov goes down, the new president will have the support he needs to retaliate. That means he's going to blame it either on the Ukrainians, Azerbaijanis, or someone within their own borders that they want to take out, probably Muslims in the Caucasus. When Russian tanks start rolling farther into Ukraine or Turkey on another land grab, they'll be able to wave around a photo of their dead president as justification. Like I told you when you were here, this is the last gasp of a dying empire. Desperate people do desperate things. Hell, if our president was hit as well, we might even support them. And I'm just giving you my best guess as to what's going on. We're not perfect. We thought Iraq had WMDs, remember?
That rings a bell, Rhys said. Keep working it. I'm going to see if Agent Scheer can get you a list of the local security forces. Maybe we're overlooking someone there. I'll have PID send them a full list, she confirmed.
Okay, thanks all. Out here, Freddy ended the call.
I think we just checked the motive block, Rhys observed.
Agent Scheer looked at her watch.
I'll pass all this along, but we're going to need more. Umbrella lands in less than an hour.
Chapter 81
Umbrella is en route, 5 miles out. He'll be here in 10 minutes.
Strain had kitted up with a low-vis mag carrier. His carbine was slung to his left side. Rhys had both 9mm pistols, courtesy of his new employer. They were on their own radios, which were not compatible with the ones used by the Secret Service. That meant that Rhys stayed close to Agent Scheer so she could relay any relevant information from her feed. It was the best that they could muster on such short notice. The former SEALs had placed themselves on opposing ends of the Teoshin Pedestrian Bridge, an elevated structure that gave them a good vantage point and reasonable mobility. Rhys and Scheer were closest to the colonnade where the presidents would be speaking, while Freddy was positioned on the west end. He had given Rhys the sat phone since he was in a better position to coordinate assets and intelligence, should that become necessary. The streets had been closed and the route had been cleared, a crowd of several hundred people all having been frisked physically and electronically by uniformed Secret Service agents filled the space in front of the colonnade. No backpacks, satchels, or briefcases were allowed inside the perimeter. A brass band was set up at stage left, facing the direction of the pedestrian bridge. Television cameras were ready to film the event, with the agreement that the live feed would be sequestered until the respective leaders were on site. A team of Ukrainian police had searched the pier that had concerned the Americans and found nothing out of the ordinary. Rhys peered into every probable hide site that he could find using his binoculars. The tough part was that this area had virtually no middle ground. The shooter was either very close or extremely distant.
I know you're here.
Where are you hiding?
Umbrella is 5 minutes out. You see anything, Freddy?
Negative, Rhys, his friend responded over the radio.
The shipping container sat at the top of the large stack of identical boxes riding on the deck of the freighter, giving them a commanding view of the harbor. They had no communications devices in the container, so everything depended on the clock. Cell phones, satellite phones, and radios all gave off electronic signatures that could be detected remotely and would give away their location. If there was anything the Americans were good at, it was locating and targeting communications equipment, specifically cell phones.
Lessons learned the hard way.
The ventilation system had been shut off 12 hours earlier to prevent heat signatures from escaping, and though the oxygen tanks that had been fitted inside allowed them to breathe through medical masks, the heavily insulated container had become incredibly hot, humid, and stagnant. Nizar closed his eyes and tried to remain calm. Finally, after what seemed like days,
Tasho nodded to Nizar that it was time to open the doors. Both men donned dark sunglasses. They each turned a crank that raised a metal panel inward, much the same way that residential windows functioned. A red cloth mesh that matched the outside paint of the container remained in place, allowing them to see out while limiting their exposure to all but the closest visual inspection. The air that rushed into the space felt like heaven, but even darkened by their sunglasses and the cloth screen, the light was blinding. The rifles were already positioned behind the openings, resting on their bipods and beanbag-like sandbags at the rear. Tasho and Nizar easily found the distinctive architecture of the colonnade in their scopes and made adjustments to their bodies and to the rifles until they found what was called a natural point of aim. Heat and moisture emanating from Nizar's breath and sweat-soaked forehead quickly fogged the rear lens of his scope. He wiped it hastily to clear the image. They had already dialed for elevation. The exact distance from their hide sight to the target had been calculated and sent to them before they'd entered the container. They knew the precise width of the ship and its position against the pier. The wind was another story. It was blowing from the southwest, which made it almost full value. At this extreme distance, knowing the wind at the muzzle wasn't enough, as it could change multiple times between rifle and target. Fortunately, coastal winds such as these were fairly consistent, and there were few terrain features in their path to cause disturbances in the air. Tasho studied the visual mirage, the movement of the water below, the sway of the tall trees near the target, and even the flags mounted atop the pier's numerous cranes through his Swarovski spotting scope. As he studied each indicator, he began to build a picture of the wind call that would determine the success or failure of their mission.
"I've got something here, Andy."
It was Fabian, the computer expert who was supporting their frantic search for some shred of evidence that could assist the team on the ground in Odessa.
"What is it?"
"I've been searching known associates of Andrenov and bumping them against every database that we have. Yuri Vatutin is Andrenov's head of security and, like most of them, he's a former FSB commando. One of the men under his command in Chechnya was Grigory Isaev. There's a very similar name, Gregory Isay, on the Russian Federal Protective Service roster the Secret Service just emailed us. Isayev means son of Isay in Russian. I think it might be the same person."
The computer didn't match the names because it wasn't an exact match. "We run into this problem constantly with Muslim names, so it's something I think about. I've just never had to do it with Russians."
Danreb snatched the list from the analyst's hands. "Get Strain on the phone. Now!"
Chapter 82
"Umbrella is 1 minute out."
"1 minute, Freddy. It's game time."
"Roger that."
The agency sat phone vibrated just as the band fired up, playing whatever the Russian equivalent was to Hail to the Chief, as President Zubarov took the stage. Reese held his hand over the radio earpiece on his left ear and put the phone up to his right.
"Donovan?"
"It's Andy. We think one of the FSO agents served with Andrenov's head of security. His name is Gregory Isay."
"Say it again, Andy. It's really loud here."
"FSO agent Gregory Isay may be your shooter."
"Fuck."
Reese communicated the name to Scheer, who made a radio call of her own. He then hit the transmit button on his radio.
"Freddy, FSO agent Gregory Isay could be our shooter. Scheer is finding out where he is."
Reese and Freddy began frantically searching the rooftops as they waited for information from Scheer. On nearly every high building, they saw a pair of figures staring through either binoculars or spotting scopes, scanning their assigned areas for threats.
On the nearby roof of a pink-and-white corner building, Strain saw a Russian sniper with no sign of an American counterpart. He looked around for a path to the building from his high perch on the pedestrian bridge. The street below was too far to drop. He would break both his legs, if he were lucky. Running farther to the west, Freddy found what he was looking for and swung his slung HK416 behind his back and out of the way. He climbed over the bridge's 6-foot chain-link railing.
I'm too old for this.
He took a deep breath and dropped onto the tiled roof of a 2-story apartment building below. He half-slid, half-ran down the roof before dropping another floor down to the flat roof next door, twisting his ankle as he landed. Limping across the flat roof, he swung his legs over the side, finding the stone wall with the toe of his boot, and dropped 6 feet onto the roof of a Volvo sedan parked on the sidewalk. Hobbling across the intersection as fast as his tender ankle allowed him, with his weapon trained on the roofline, Freddy moved toward his new objective. Out of breath from the exertion, he keyed the mic button attached to his armor.
Reese, I'm headed to a building northwest of your position. I think that's where the shooter is.
Roger that. I'm having Shear send people there now to support. Freddy took the 3 doorway steps as fast as he could with his injured ankle and jerked on the wood-framed glass door. Locked. Without hesitation, he smashed through the glass with the suppressor and raked away the standing panes before stepping inside. The ground floor of the 3-story building was a clothing boutique that was dark except for the sunlight filtering through the canopied windows. Using the light mounted on his weapons rail, he located the unlocked back door and made entry. An old wooden stairway began at the end of the narrow hallway behind the door, and he moved as quickly as he could while searching the area above for potential threats.
Don't rush to your death.
Freddy had made his way up 4 flights of stairs and was turning the corner to approach the 3rd floor. It was dead quiet inside the building, but for the creaks of the stairs below his feet. It actually startled him when the radio came alive in his ear.
Freddy, the counter-sniper at your location is not answering his radio call. Alpha Group is moving toward your location, but I doubt they're going to get there in time to help.
Freddy keyed his mic twice in understanding.
Chapter 83. The lone figure standing on the rooftop was the sign that President Zubarov had taken the stage. The snipers couldn't distinguish facial features at such a distance, so everything depended on time, place, and the signal from inside the perimeter. It was time to take their shots. Tasho moved from the spotting scope to his rifle. He took a final look at the wind and decided to bracket the shot. Calling wind was as much an art as a science, especially at this distance. He would make one wind hold himself and give Nizar a slightly different hold, statistically increasing the chances that one of their shots would find its mark. Winds were tricky.
Confirm 12.9 mils of elevation.
Nizar looked at the dial on top of the optic.
12.9 mils confirmed.
Hold 2.9 mils right.
2.9 mils right,
Nizar repeated.
Ready.
Ready.
3, 2, 1. Boom!
The sound inside the container was deafening, the overpressure event of their shots reverberating through the enclosed space. The propellant gases from the muzzle blew the cloth screens off the openings before the bullets left the barrels. The copper projectiles exiting the muzzles at just under 3,000 feet per second. The bullet's arc took them high above the physical obstacles that lay beneath the container and the colonnade during their 3.171 second flight. Their total drop was over 970 inches from the muzzle to the target, accounted for by the 1,000-yard zero and elevation adjustments made in the scope. The 13-mile-per-hour west wind pushed the bullets 221 inches laterally as they flew. Tasho had called the wind perfectly for his own shot, which meant that Nizar's 350-grain bullet
smashed into one of the colonnade's pillars, showering the area with a puff of white dust that many onlookers mistook for an explosion. The Shishani's bullet created a different, grislier shower as it passed through President Zubarov's abdomen, sending blood, bone, bowel tissue, and digested matter across the stage. The bullet severed the Russian president's vertebrae, and gravity sent his body crashing downward before anyone knew what had happened. Even had the band's noise not drowned out the rifle's report or the bullet's sonic crack, he would have been on the ground before anyone heard it. Tasho and Nizar had completed their mission. Inshallah. It was time for the other shooter to complete his. Reese saw the formation of agents moving toward the stage react instantly. Umbrella was shoved down and away from the stage by the agents closest to him. The crowd's confused cries transformed into panicked screams as the band members dropped their instruments and dove for cover. A team of black-clad counter-assault team agents wearing Kevlar body armor and helmets armed with KAC SR-16 carbines emerged from around the Vorontsov Palace and moved to dominate the terrain as Umbrella was rushed to safety by his detail. With POTUS out of the line of fire, Reese turned his attention back to the Russian sniper that Freddy had seen standing alone on the roof. Unable to see him from his current vantage point, Reese moved to higher ground. Freddy reached the roof level of the stairway, and not surprisingly, the door had been blocked. With no breaching equipment in his kit, Strain moved the selector switch on his carbine to full auto and emptied a magazine into the door, blasting the deadbolt and door jamb into splinters of wood and metal. He ejected the empty magazine, inserted a fresh one from his chest rig, and slapped the bolt stop before kicking the door open and taking the corner onto the roof. He moved quickly, since the element of surprise had been spoiled by the 30 brown-tip rounds that he'd sent through the door. He stepped laterally and saw a pool of blood expanding across the flat metal roof. As he continued, he saw the source of the blood 10 yards away. The supine figure of the Secret Service agent assigned to the rooftop counter-sniper position. He wasn't moving. Freddy took another step to his right and saw the long barrel of a Russian sniper rifle turning to face him, the sniper rising from his knees as he turned. Freddy found the sniper in his scope and squeezed a half-dozen rapid-fire rounds into his torso, shooting him into the ground as he fell sideways onto the roof, his heavy rifle hitting the deck next to him. The SEAL fired 2 additional security rounds into the Russian's head and dashed forward to assess the wounds of the American agent.
"Reese, we've got a man down up here. The threat is down, too. I say again, the threat is down. Over."
The Secret Service counter-sniper had been shot in the throat, undoubtedly by the suppressed Yarigin handgun lying on the roof beside the Russian sniper. Strain applied pressure to the American's wound. He could feel a faint pulse as he pressed on the source of the bleeding, bright red blood flowing between his fingers as he knelt beside the gravely wounded agent.
"Reese, we need a medic on this roof ASAP. I've got a critical patient here. Over."
"I'm working on it, Freddy. Over." Nizar worked the bolt instinctively and loaded another round from the rifle's magazine. Per his orders, he transitioned his scope to the 3-story building to the right of the stage and corrected his elevation for the closer shot. He had already done the math on the wind and used the reticle to hold for the drift. His target was kneeling instead of in the prone position that Nizar expected, which made for an even easier target. He exhaled and began to take the slack out of the trigger. Reese had lost sight of Freddy kneeling behind the roof's parapet wall, but from his elevated position, he had a view of the SUVs containing the Ukrainian Alpha Group assaulters headed to support.
"Freddy, be advised the Alpha team is on your street. They'll have a medic with them, so just hold tight. Over."
"Roger that, Reese. Is Umbrella safe?"
"Check. He's secure, Freddy. But President Zubarov is down. No idea where the shot came from, so stay down."
A chirping on the satellite phone alerted Reese to an incoming call.
Freddy, we have a call coming in on the secure line. Stand by.
His right hand squeezing the wounded agent's neck, Freddy reached his left hand up to activate his radio. Reese would never get a response.
Nizar felt the recoil and muzzle blast.
Russian down. Two Russians down.
He turned to face Tasho.
We did it, Tasho,
a smiling Nizar said.
That we did, Nizar.
The older sniper put his head back to his scope for one last look at the chaos they had created, and almost simultaneously felt a strange slap to the right side of his head. His face felt warm and wet as he turned back toward Nizar, wondering why he was having trouble seeing. Nizar fired two more rounds from the suppressed Stechkin pistol into his sniper partner's head, just as he had been instructed by General Yedid. A Chechen needed to be blamed for this. Nizar understood that he was an expendable asset, like the legend he had just killed. Today he was thankful that he wasn't Chechen. He wiped Tasho's blood from his eyes and saw his lifeless body slumped forward over his rifle in a pool of crimson.
The student bests the master.
His ears rang both from the suppressed rifle shots and from the even louder blast of the 9x18mm in the close confines of the container. The darkened steel box stank of sweat, blood, and burnt gunpowder. It was time to disappear.
Hello? Reese said into the phone.
Mr. Strain? The voice asked over the encrypted satellite link.
No, it's Donovan, Reese answered.
Ah, Mr. Donovan, this is Dr. Bellinger. May I speak to Mr. Strain? It's an urgent matter.
You'll have to settle for me, Doc. Things just got crazy here.
Very well. Something didn't sit right with me on General Yadid's interrogation, so I spent some additional time with him. I'll spare you the details, but after some additional persuasion, I have something for you.
Tell me, but make it quick.
The snipers are not your only threat.
What?
Have you heard of the nerve agent Novichok?
I have. Isn't it what killed that Russian spy in London recently?
That is correct. The assassination in Great Britain was of a GRU agent named Sergei Skripal. The Russian government always denied any involvement. It would not be a stretch to think that it was a test of Novichok on an adversary of Andrenov. They would have known each other in the GRU, and remember, that was just a minute portion. Novichok is a binary compound that...
Binary? What does that mean? You need to mix it?
Yes. It was made to be stored in two parts in an attempt to bypass the chemical weapons convention. Combined, they are more toxic than VX or sarin, 7 to 10 times as lethal, to be precise. It was developed in Uzbekistan, but that facility was dismantled by international inspectors led by the United States in 1999. It was always suspected that those binary compounds were sent to Russia and Syria.
What are you telling me, Doc? That Yadid has a chemical weapons attack planned here?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Shit! Is there an antidote?
Reese asked urgently.
Atropine can counter the chemical, but the doses required are in and of themselves lethal. How would they disperse it?
Airborne would be the most effective.
Airspace is shut down. It's something else.
Stand by, Mr. Donovan. I'll ask our new source, General Yadid.
Reese waited an excruciating few minutes while filling in Agent Shear on the latest development.
With everything you've told me, this makes sense, she said. The president is on his way back to the airfield. He'll be airborne in minutes.
Mr. Donovan! Mr. Donovan! The satellite phone barked back to life.
Yeah, go.
It's the catacombs. It's not coming down from the air. It's coming up from the catacombs beneath the square.
Shit! Kim, where was that entrance to the catacombs, the one that led to the bar that's sealed up?
Follow me, she shouted as she sprinted for the door.
Freddy!
Reese keyed his radio.
Freddy!
Damn radios!
There had not been an attempt on the president's life since Reagan in 1981, and no matter how well-trained, disciplined, and prepared the Secret Service was, an attempt on their principal with shots fired and another head of state down still resulted in chaos. Reese knew chaos well. He'd lived with it as a constant companion in combat, learned to expect it and thrive in it. In chaos, there was opportunity. In this case, it had led to opportunity for the enemy. Reese recognized that fact as clearly as if he'd planned it himself. If the Secret Service was converging on the president, as was their primary responsibility, that left local law enforcement liaisons covering down on the areas that had formerly been secured by the most effective protection force on the planet. It left those locations vulnerable. Reese and Agent Scheer hit the street at a full sprint. As a member of the advance team, part of Kim's job was to know all the routes of ingress and egress. She didn't even pause to get her bearings. She knew exactly where to go.
"This is Scheer," the Secret Service agent yelled into her lapel mic as she wove through the street that was now clogged with people, moving away from the confusion and congestion of the promenade. Police whistles blared, punctuating an already confusing scene. Reese wished he had a long gun, but also knew that might put him in the crosshairs of a local police officer just trying to do his job. Both Americans kept their sidearms in their holsters as they rushed toward the water.
"Where are we going?" Reese yelled above the crowd.
"Stay close. We had an agent and local PD at all known entrances to the catacombs in the area. The closest is just at the base of these cliffs," she said, motioning ahead. "From what we could tell, none of them led directly under the colonnade."
They slowed their sprint as they approached the nearest cross street that hadn't been shut down for the president's speeches. Kim flashed her Secret Service badge at a police officer who looked confused as to what to do in all the commotion as they darted through a chorus of blaring horns to the walkway that overlooked the Black Sea.
"There,"
Agent Scheer said, starting to move down the makeshift trail and pointing to the rocky beach about 100 yards down from their position.
"Let's go."
"Hold on," Reese said, catching back up with her, scanning the beach and the surrounding area. "Where's your agent?"
"He should be moving to a link-up point and then converging on the president's position," Scheer confirmed.
"Okay, looks clear," Reese said, "but I don't see the local PD anywhere." His eyes instinctively took in all the probable hide sites a sniper would use to cover the entrance to the catacombs below. "Take a breath, look around, make a call."
"There should be a uniformed officer down there, but you never really know with the host nation fo—"
Agent Scheer never finished her sentence. Reese was already throwing her to the ground as fully automatic rifle fire raked across their position. Kim was in the lead and took 2 rounds on her way to the dirt, Reese grabbing the back of her shirt and dragging her as he crawled to cover behind a huge boulder. 300 yards down, halfway down the embankment. It wasn't the best position for the shooter. The fully automatic fire told Reese it wasn't a sniper. Most likely it was the least experienced of the group whose responsibility was to guard the entrance, and he was doing just that.
"Where are you hit?"
Reese yelled, his hands searching for entrance and exit wounds, quite aware that they were in a bad position if there was a flanking element ready to maneuver.
I...
"Where?" Reese demanded.
"Leg,"
Kim said breathlessly. Reese finished his assessment, his head on a swivel, going between Kim and the avenues of approach to their location. In the intensity that was combat, it was easy to treat the first wound you found, while another, less obvious one, drained the life from your injured comrade. "Pressure here," Reese ordered, placing Kim's hand on her thigh. Blood had begun to seep through her pant leg. It didn't look like an arterial bleed or a broken femur, but now was the time to do the basics. He knew he should win the fight first, but something in his DNA wouldn't let him leave her in a growing pool of blood. He needed to work quickly.
"Do you have a tourniquet?" "Yes, ankle.
Reese reached down and pulled up her left pant leg.
Nothing.
Then the right. Wrapped around her leg just above the ankle was a combat tourniquet. Reese recognized the North American Rescue tourniquet as the same type he'd taken downrange on many a deployment, and he knew just how to use it. Sliding it over her leg just above what looked like at least two bullet wounds, he cinched it down, twisted the spindle, and secured it under a plastic catch.
"Give me your radio," Reese said, snatching it off her waist and yanking the wire out that led to her earpiece.
"This is James Donovan," he said into the radio. "I'm with Agent Shear at just across... Kim, where are we?"
"Across... across Chonamorska Street, southwest of the colonnade," she panted, pain obvious in her eyes.
Reese pressed transmit again. "On the seaside of Chonamorska Street, Agent Shear has been shot in the leg. We need agents and medical personnel on scene. Be aware we have one enemy combatant approximately 300 yards south of our position, halfway down the hill. At least one shooter with a rifle. We have a chemical weapon threat to the area. Clear the colonnade. It's Novichok, and it's in the catacombs now. Delivery mechanism unknown."
Reese didn't wait for a reply. Instead, he shoved the radio into Kim's hand, ripped off his long-sleeve shirt, and started shoving it into her wound cavity.
"Fuck! That hurts!"
Kim gritted through clenched teeth.
"You are going to be fine. Keep monitoring the radio and guide them in." "How many rounds do you have in that pistola?" Reese asked.
12. One extra mag."
"Okay, good," Reese said, recognizing the SIG P229 and 357 SIG that Kim drew from her holster. "You have a flashlight?" Reese asked.
"Yes."
"Give it to me," Reese said, stuffing it into his pocket. "I want you to start putting rounds into our bad guy, or at least in his general vicinity. He's about 300 yards in front of us and about halfway down the embankment. There's a lone tree just above him. Find that tree and start shooting about 20 yards down from it. Can you do that?"
"Yes. What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to flank him. You ready?" Reese asked. Kim looked up at the man who had transformed before her eyes into an instrument of war.
"Kim," Reese shouted, "are you ready?"
Kim nodded and pushed her back against the rock that had provided them sanctuary. Reese moved to a knee, drawing the larger pistol the CIA had issued him for the trip, and handed it to the wounded Secret Service agent.
"I want you to start sending rounds as soon as I break cover. Action is faster than reaction, so I'll be fine. But I need you to keep his head down. Shoot both your mags. You hold on to mine. That's a backup, in case they have anyone in the area we haven't accounted for. That's your last resort."
"What about you?"
Kim asked in astonishment. "Don't you need a weapon?"
"I've got an extra," Reese said. Kim gazed into his brown eyes and shivered.
"Ready?" he asked again.
"Go."
Reese broke from cover as Kim rolled around the opposite side of the rock. She searched frantically for the tree, finding it and looking below it, just as muzzle flashes began to erupt, sending rounds in Reese's direction. Kim started shooting. Reese charged up the embankment to the road and out of the line of fire, sprinting along the path at the top of the ridge. He felt strong. Traffic was at a standstill to his right, and pedestrians whose curiosity had drawn them to the sound of gunfire stopped to watch the strange man with the black backpack running at breakneck speed along the coast. He could hear the sound of Agent Shear's 357 SIG behind him. The fully automatic fire stopped, its owner either behind cover or trying to find the source of the incoming rounds.
"Always improve your fighting position."
Reese swung the backpack off his shoulders and reached inside, still moving at full speed. His hand found the wooden shaft of Freddy's tomahawk. Leaving the backpack in his wake, Reese flipped the Kydex sheath off the ancient weapon and let it fall to the ground. He needed intel on the opposing force, and the hawk would give him options that his pistol couldn't. His legs pumped, his eyes evaluating the terrain while searching for threats. Reese spotted his landmark, the lone tree on the slope. It was 100 yards away and he was closing fast. He had attempted to track Kim's shots, knowing that she had only 24 rounds, but wasn't sure of the exact count. It didn't matter. He was committed. Reese broke from the trail and cut down the steep embankment. Their assailant had found Kim's position and was back on target.
His fully auto approach was his mistake, and it was going to cost him. Reese watched the earth move ahead of him as he charged down the incline. His target was concealed under a brown blanket and had rolled to his side to change mags when Reese pounced from above and just behind his left flank. Reese drove the tomahawk down and deep just to the right of the shooter's spine. With no body armor to contend with, the sharp blade made short work of the bone and muscle protecting the terrorist's vital organs. Reese's momentum and the intense spasms of the shooter's body in reaction to the violent intrusion sent them tumbling 50 yards to the base of the hill. They hit hard, but not hard enough to do any real damage. Reese scrambled to his feet as his target struggled to untangle himself from his sling. Reese was on him in a heartbeat, forcing him onto his back. The human body can take a lot of abuse, and Reese's initial strike was not enough to kill. As much as the primal side of him wanted to end it, he needed information. The former SEAL trapped the AK-type rifle with his left knee, crushing the windpipe with his left arm, tomahawk at the ready in his right.
English?
Reese hissed, glaring into the eyes of the man beneath him. The eyes betrayed recognition and revulsion, but nothing more. Reese had seen eyes like that before, eyes that revealed such burning hatred that the threat of death had no effect. Death only delivered them to salvation. With a possible chemical weapon attack on a civilian population imminent, Reese wasn't about to wait for direction. Take charge and lead. How many men are in the tunnel? This guy wasn't going to say a word. Knowing that he had been an active participant in a WMD attack made Reese's next decision an easy one. He didn't have time to take this guy apart piece by piece in the hopes he'd paint a clearer picture of the opposition awaiting him in the catacombs. A city of innocent men, women, and children needed him to finish this, and it didn't matter how many enemy combatants were in the tunnels, Reese was going in. He pulled away from the man who had moments before had him pinned down with bursts of AK fire and swung the spike on the hilt of Freddy's tomahawk down at an angle, through his temple into his brain. The body shuddered as Reese removed the hawk, spun it in his hand, and drove it blade first through the skull to finish the job. Reese removed and inspected the AK from the dead man. No magazine. He checked the chamber. Empty. He removed the last magazine from the shooter's chest rig, pushed down on the top round with his thumb to ensure it was fully loaded, inserted it into the magwell, and racked the charging handle before moving back up the shoreline to a cement bunker with a rusted metal door. The entrance to the catacombs.
Chapter 84. Though Akram couldn't be sure, he thought he heard gunfire outside. If true, that meant that local police had made a move toward the beach and Ziad had killed them with his AK. Well, maybe not all of them. Ziad was the youngest of the group, and he was nothing if not enthusiastic. In all likelihood, reinforcements were being called in, and soon Ziad would be dead. Martyred for the cause. He would hold them off and buy the team time to complete their mission. It was too late to stop them at this point. As the most senior member of the team, and with his years of experience in the Syrian army and then the military side of the Mukhabarat, Akram was the only one who knew how to mix the binary compounds to create the Novichok nerve toxin. His most recent posting had been to the Syrian Scientific Studies and Research Center in Masyaf, located on the eastern side of the Jabal Ansariya Mountains in northwestern Syria. It had somehow managed to escape targeting by the latest round of attacks from the west, airstrikes launched by the British, the French, and, of course, their American masters. It was not lost on Akram that it was in Masyaf that the Islamic sect known as Assassins were formed in the 11th century. General Yadid had paid him well, looked over him, and ensured his upward trajectory in the Mukhabarat. Now, just like the famous Fida'i from centuries past, Akram was being passed the torch. The four other men and one woman who made up the team were there to get him to this point. They were there to protect him. General Yadid did not give Akram the exact target, but had said enough for him to believe it was someone important, perhaps even a leader from one of the countries responsible for the cowardly attacks on his country. He was to be the personal scepter of President Bashar al-Assad and strike back against the West. They had targeted his homeland with sanctions and the might of their military.
Unfortunately for them, they've missed the chemical research center built into the mountain that had been the birthplace of the assassins, he thought. Today they will reap what they'd sown.
Launched from hundreds of miles away, missiles could miss their targets. The white powder he had just mixed by combining the two Novichok binary compounds would not miss. This weapon did not need to be as precise as a rifle's bullet or a smart bomb dropped from above. This was a weapon of terror, unseen and unavoidable. It would not discriminate. They had successfully tested it in a minute portion in the rebel town of Duma and had seen its effectiveness firsthand. One touch of the toxin on the skin was enough to cause violent convulsions, followed by paralysis, and then respiratory and cardiac arrest. Western intelligence agencies had misinterpreted it as a chlorine gas attack when it had in fact been a test of the Novichok that had been moved to Syria from Nukus, Uzbekistan, after the fall of the Soviet Union in advance of UN chemical weapons inspections. There, it had been studied and improved upon. Now it was ready, safe in its binary components. The mixture of the two substances created the deadliest nerve toxin known to man. Most people had heard of sarin gas and had a healthy fear and understanding of its devastating power, but until recently, Novichok had remained a mystery. While it was a similar class of toxin, Novichok was over 1,000 times as potent as sarin, rendering any antidotes completely ineffective. A microgram of exposure was lethal and would, in the amount ready to be unleashed onto the streets of Odessa, render the entire area uninhabitable for generations. The perfect substance for terror's lasting legacy. It would be the most severe blow to the West since the attacks of 9/11, and would be the revenge that President Assad had publicly promised his people. General Yadid had even passed along blessings from the president himself. I will not fail. It had taken some effort to carry the equipment into the tunnels, but they were able to do it, moving to their set point ahead of schedule. Faya and Tawfiq had taken care of the two men guarding the entrance without much trouble. That was the benefit of having a female on the team. It gave them the ability to close with an unsuspecting male target. It was rumored that President Assad had mandated the creation of the all-female commando battalions himself. These lionesses of national defense now made up a battalion of the elite Republican Guard. After 5 years as a lioness, Faya had been recruited into the Mukhabarat following her performance on the front lines subduing insurgent forces in Damascus in 2015. And General Yadid had been paying her a retainer ever since. That she was also attractive didn't hurt. In this case, it allowed her to hold hands with Tawfiq as they walked the beach, stopping to ask the two local police officers guarding the catacombs what all the commotion was about in the streets above. Lovers looking to spend some time alone by the sea, oblivious to the world around them. Their stab wounds were savage and lethal as the counterfeit lovers went right for the throats of the unsuspecting police officers, just as they had been trained to do in service to their country. A whistle brought Akram and Hassan down from the trail above, Akram carrying the fan in a large backpack, while Hassan carried the two small canisters that would forever change the world. Ziad was set up with his AK on the hillside with a clear view of the entrance to the tunnels. Now, deep in the tunnel system, it was time.
Condensation had built up inside the protective clothing and soaked Akram in a layer of sweat. He knew the others were in a similar condition. The thin plastic suits designed as airtight barriers against the evil they were unleashing. They had secured the cylindrical tube leading off the fan directly to the side shaft with a combination of tape and rubber cement, forming an airtight seal leading to the street above. Originally constructed and connected to the catacombs as drainage to allow water trapped in the colonnade to find its way to the ocean, it was now a conduit of death. Each member of the team worked for the military side of Syria's famed Mukhabarat, and each also worked for General Yadid. He had chosen to activate them for this mission because they all had extensive training in unconventional chemical munition delivery systems. The thin plastic suits would serve their purpose. All they needed to do was carefully pour the mixed compound into the yellow tube, then attach the fan and turn it on. So simple, so effective. There was no stopping them now. Chapter 85. Darkness. No NODs, no suppressor, no team. Rhys slipped inside and began to work his way down the tunnel. That he wasn't killed right away told him whoever was ahead had been counting on the rear security he had just eliminated to cover their six. That, or they had someone barricaded deeper in the tunnel. He had what was probably 28 or 30 rounds in the AK, his SIG P365 in the ankle holster, a surefire flashlight from Agent Shear, and the tomahawk. What lay ahead in the blackness? One man? Two? A squad of heavily armed terrorists? Had they already mixed the binary components of the Novichok? Were thousands of Ukrainians already dead and dying from the deadly compound? Rhys pressed on. Rhys remembered stories of the tunnel rats in Vietnam from his father's unit, descending into the subterranean labyrinths carrying nothing but a flashlight and a 1911 handgun. And he remembered his friends and teammates going into tunnel complexes in the mountains of Afghanistan at the start of the war. He refrained from using the flashlight as he didn't want to telegraph his arrival, though it was in his left hand pressed against the stock of the AK. He was one man against an entrenched enemy force with an unknown number of weapons, in possession of a deadly nerve toxin, hidden somewhere ahead in complete darkness, beneath the streets of an ancient city in what amounted to an unmapped labyrinth of caves and tunnels three levels deep. The passage began to narrow, the air cold and heavy. Rhys used his left shoulder to guide him forward along the corridor, the cold, damp limestone walls bearing witness to yet another battle in a new war. Rhys heard them first. Coming to a stop, he listened. Did they have night vision and IR lights? Rhys was about to find out. Like he had done as a bow hunter making the final approach on his prey, Rhys removed his shoes to quiet his movement as he inched forward. A light began to illuminate the tunnel, and Rhys worked his way toward it. As much as he wanted to sprint into the breach, he knew he wouldn't do anyone any good if even one of those he pursued lived to launch the toxin. A new sound made Rhys freeze in his tracks. What was that? It sounded like a vacuum. Then it went silent. Rhys moved forward more quickly, the light ahead getting brighter. He was close and could hear a strange, almost computerized whispering in Arabic. Taking a knee, Rhys leaned to his right, away from the wall, to get a better angle on his target. 20 yards down the tunnel was a puzzling sight that turned to horror as Rhys's brain processed the scene. A lantern illuminated a man standing guard with an AK similar to the one Rhys now carried. His attention wasn't on security, though he did look in Rhys's direction every few seconds. His focus was on his companions. Three people wearing white chemical suits with respirators were working to attach what looked like an industrial fan to a bright yellow tube, the type used to ventilate sewer systems through manholes or construction tunnels that could be maneuvered in and around corners like an oversized vacuum. It was fixed to the wall of the cavern. It took a moment for Reese to process what was happening, but then it all came together. Designed to ventilate small spaces, the fan and its attached tube had been turned into a weapon of terror. The high-powered fan was on the floor of the tunnel, plugged into a mobile battery pack. Strewn around it were two discarded plastic containers with Cyrillic writing. They were in the final stages of setting up their system designed to blow the lethal Novichok down a side tunnel and into the colonnade above. It was ready to go, just as Dr. Bellinger had briefed. The toxin was inside the maze-like catacombs, and the fan was set to blow it into the crowded streets of Odessa.
Ziad?
Reese heard the digitized voice-altering challenge through the respirator from the guard with the AK, who now peered attentively in Reese's direction. The fan started to turn.
Shit!
Reese answered with five rounds from the AK, but without illumination to line up his sights, in the dark his shots went wide. The guard immediately began firing on full auto in Reese's direction, forcing him back and out of the cone of fire. The rifle fire was deafening inside the confines of the cave, and the muzzle flashes were blinding.
Fortune favors the bold.
Reese depressed the button on his flashlight and dropped it to the ground, at the same time moving to the opposite side of the tunnel. With his enemy's attention on the bright light, Reese stitched him up with another 10 rounds from the rifle and charged forward toward the fan. As their accomplice dropped dead on the floor of the catacombs, one of the conspirators reached for an AK as two others retreated into the darkness, disappearing down the tunnel complex. Rounds from Reese's AK found their mark in the upper chest of the chemical suit-clad terrorist, and two more exploded through the respirator's face mask, dropping him in a bloody heap. Reese resisted the urge to pursue, and instead stopped in front of the large fan, the high-pitched whine of the electric motor pushing the chemical agent toward daylight. Within seconds, the deadly vapor would reach ground level, killing hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians, transforming the entire area into a toxic wasteland. Reese's finger began to take the slack out of the heavy trigger as he aimed at the fan's motor. Then he stopped and released the pressure.
Think, Reese, adapt. Fuck it.
Reese couldn't read whatever language was on the dial, but it was as intuitive as could be. Reaching down, he cranked the dial to the left and felt the fan switch directions, pulling the Novichok back into the ventilation tube, returning it to the catacombs. Turning to run, Reese stopped and directed the fan deeper into the tunnel system toward those who had unleashed it. As it sucked the deadly nerve toxin into the underworld, he sprinted back the way he had come. Chapter 86. By the time Reese emerged from the depths of the catacombs, the beach was teeming with local police, Ukrainian military, and a few Secret Service agents left behind to coordinate with the host nation. Reese spotted CIA case officer Douglas and briefed him on what he'd seen in the tunnels, stressing that two terrorists in white chemical suits were contaminated with a nerve toxin and needed to be shot on sight if they made it to an exit. Dr. Bellinger had sounded the alarm after his call to Reese, which set off a chain reaction and triggered the Ukrainian Ministry of Emergency Situations WMD response protocol, which was on its highest level of alert due to the high-profile event in Odessa. Hazmat teams were already sealing off the catacombs while the military coordinated an evacuation of the immediate and surrounding areas.
"How's Shear?" Reese asked as soon as he was able.
"She's going to make it, Reese. But I do have some bad news. It's about your friend."
By the time Reese made his way back to Freddy's last position, Alpha Group had secured the scene.
The wounded Secret Service sniper had been transported to a local hospital, where U.S. medical personnel were fighting to save his life. There were black tarps over two bodies on the roof. Reese knelt at his friend's side and pulled back the dark plastic. Tears welled up in his eyes as he cradled the head of the devoted husband and father of three, who had given an entire career in service of his nation, and now his own life, to protect its president. After the shock of losing his entire troop in Afghanistan and his pregnant wife and child in his own home, Reese didn't think he could feel any more grief. He was wrong. Reese's world went into slow motion as activity swirled around him. The Ukrainian Reaction Force efficiently maintained security while doing their best to protect what was now more than a crime scene. This had been an act of war. All Reese could manage was to stare into the lifeless face of one of the best men he'd ever known. Chapter 87. Ramstein Air Base, Germany. October. Freddy's body had been bagged and was surrounded by ice to keep it as cool as possible. Reese accompanied his friend's remains on the C-17 that also carried the Secret Service's vehicles from the President's motorcade. The Air Force loadmasters had carefully and respectfully secured Freddy's body bag to the aircraft's metal cargo floor. Reese sat next to it. When they'd landed in Germany to refuel and link up with the President and the rest of the Presidential Protection Detail, an agent approached Reese with an offer to ride in Air Force One at the President's invitation. Reese politely declined. He wasn't leaving his teammate's side. The NCIS investigation in Afghanistan had robbed him of his duty to accompany the fallen members of his troop home, and he wasn't about to let that happen again. Reese had spoken to Vic Rodriguez on the sat phone and helped him coordinate the notification of Freddy's family. When Joni Strain's bedroom light turned on in Beaufort, South Carolina, at 6:13 a.m. the following morning, Rodriguez knocked quietly on the front door. The knock sent her heart racing as she realized that the dreaded moment that every military wife fears had come, a nightmare from which she would never awake. Joni didn't know Vic, so she didn't recognize him when she cracked the door in a light robe. But she knew the Master Chief in dress blues from Freddy's last military command who accompanied him. Her eyes moved from his ribbons to the trident to his sad eyes. Her knees buckled and she collapsed to the floor. At Landstuhl Regional Medical Center, Freddy was transferred to an aluminum metal casket and repacked with ice. Reese couldn't help but think that the casket, with its metal handles and locking clasps, looked a lot like a large rifle case. Freddy would like that. To his credit, President Grimes had waited in Germany for the SEAL's remains to be prepared, making an impromptu visit to the airbase and hospital to boost morale and thank the men and women recovering from wounds sustained in combat before their transfer back to the United States. Six uniformed airmen loaded the flag-draped box back onto the C-17, the Secret Service agents forming an honor guard between the military cargo van and the aircraft's ramp. Nearly all of them had served in the military, and many had lost friends and teammates in the process. Reese felt the dread building in his body as the massive jet approached the homeland. He knew he would have to face Joni, and he wasn't sure he could. What can I say to her? The only reason he's dead is because they sent him to find me. If I'd turned down their offer, Freddy would still be alive. His own grief over the loss of his friend was overshadowed by overwhelming guilt. He had to be strong for her, though, as Freddy would have been for Lauren if their roles had been reversed, but Lauren was gone. Everyone was gone. As the aircraft landed at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland, Reese could see the crowd of people and vehicles arranged near one of the hangars, a hearse, a limousine,
a crisp formation of men dressed in black. The C-17 taxied toward the hangar, and the pilot shut down the powerful Pratt & Whitney turbofan engines. The air crew quietly removed the straps, securing the metal casket to the floor, and stood aside. As the ramp lowered, Reese could see two lines of Freddy's highly decorated former teammates, many of them with thick beards but still dressed immaculately in their blues, forming a cordon between the aircraft and the waiting hearse. Joni stood on the tarmac, her hands on Sam's shoulders, their two other children at her side, her face a mask of stoic grief. Vic Rodriguez had escorted her throughout her tragic journey and was an arm's length away. A couple, who must have been her parents, stood beside her, along with an older couple, whom Reese recognized as Freddy's parents.
"Everyone looks so old."
Reese stood at attention at the head of the casket as a SEAL detail approached. Reese knew the Master Chief leading the grim progression, and caught an almost imperceptible nod of recognition as the two men made eye contact. They had to be wondering what in the hell Reese was doing there. They'd sent a team to kill him at the Pentagon's orders just months prior, and had followed the ensuing fallout closely. The smart money had been on him being dead. The press had been kept away at the family's request, and because every face in this crowd was from a unit that the Pentagon doesn't publicly acknowledge. Freddy's fight was over, but these men were still very much a part of it, at the tip of the U.S. military's powerful spear. Reese watched as the flag-draped casket was carried toward his family and, as the wind blew across the open tarmac, noticed that one of the SEALs carrying him wore a prosthetic lower leg.
Where do we find guys like this?
After the casket was loaded and the honor guard dismissed, Reese approached Joni, who was speaking to one of the senior enlisted SEALs. When she caught sight of Reese, she moved to him and hugged him so tightly that it stunned him, her big blue eyes red and swollen from endless crying.
"I'm so sorry about Lauren and Lucy, Reese."
"Her husband came home in a box, and she still offers me condolences from my family."
I'm sorry about Freddy.
He died like he lived. A hero."
"Vic told me that you were with him, Reese. It means so much to me that you were there, that he didn't die alone. I didn't even know where he was."
"I'm sorry I couldn't save him, Joni." "It was instant. He wasn't in any pain."
"I know. Vic told me."
Reese felt the almost imperceptible nod of her head against his chest through the tears.
"When he left the teams, I was so relieved. He said this job would be safer, and that I wouldn't have to worry."
"It should have been, Joni. I'm so sorry." "It's my fault, Joni. It should have been me." Joni's head snapped back.
"Don't you ever think that, James Reese. Not ever. Do you understand me?"
"Pardon the interruption, ma'am, but the President wishes to see you," said a Navy O-5 standing nearby.
Joni Strain stood up straight and took a deep breath. She wiped her tears with a tissue and looked her husband's friend directly in the eye.
"Thank you for bringing him home to me, Reese."
"I'll find who did this, Joni. I'll find everyone responsible, I promise."
"I know,"
she said, then nodded and turned away.